Hello and welcome to recording number 40 of Gary Gygax's Saga of Old City, an annotated reading. We're starting up here on page number 290, and it is page number, paragraph number, I'm sorry, paragraph 6. And to give you a little background here, for context, Gord and Chert have traveled to the city of Nelix, and then visited with Iquander and met up with Curly Greenleaf in the near the town of Mauve Castle, which I'm assuming is Mauve Castle, but in the book is spelled Mauve. And they're in this little tavern called the Manticore's Tail, and they're talking about traveling to a ruined city. I thought it was the Celadon Forest, but I believe it's a valley in the Aber Alls, and I'm not sure if that is located in the Celadon. The Celadon's been mentioned several times. All right. Here is the start. Both young men grumbled, but there was nothing to do but go along with Curly's plan. He wouldn't say anything in the common room of the tavern, and wouldn't go elsewhere until he'd eaten. Chert said he was famished, and he did consume vast quantities of chow at every opportunity. And Gord was also feeling pangs of hunger, so they nodded acceptance of Curly's terms and ordered a meal. Soon the three were busily demolishing a roast capon, some egg and mutton kidney pie, and various and sundry comestibles delivered in stages by the serving woman. Finally, after the last bones were stripped bare of meat, the pie dish clean, and nothing but a few crumbs of bread to be seen on the table, Greenleaf sat back patting his round belly, and Chert belched contentedly as he swigged down another pot of stout. Gord, having finished much sooner than his two companions, had been waiting impatiently for this event. "If you two Gundyguts have finally stopped stuffing yourselves," he said, "I think it high time we went upstairs so that Chert and I can learn the real meat of our chase halfway across the Flaness." Still beaming with happiness at his repletion, the druid nodded and arose, leading the way to the rooms they had taken above. Break. So here we have a nice little thing. Gygax, you know, he really believes in adding a little detail to some of their opportunities to eat. And it's always nice. So here they are in Mauve Castle, which is a town, and I hadn't really been aware of that. But they're here in Mauve Castle at an inn, and so Gygax always likes to add something, I think, about, you know, the various foods that are available. Nothing too exotic here, but, you know, very, very nice little detail to have added here about the kind of foods you can have at an inn. And I always find that that is a nice little addition to your role-playing session, so that you're not just walking in and you get a list of stuff. If you add a little thing about the meal being satisfying, that it's well-cooked, that if, you know, just various things about the characters feeling hungry, you know, I always like that. So there's nothing here, really, that is more than a little description of a little added fluff and color to what is just a plain occurrence. All right, Chris has added a map right here of the Aber Alls Mountains. They're off in the, it's on the Greyhawk Fiction channel here, text channel. And if you do get a chance, it's July 21st, 2021. So if you wanted to find it there, you could go up to that point and rediscover, you know, what we're talking about for recording 40. Now, there is Mauve Castle, and I'm not quite sure where in the Aberals this location that they're going to is located or what it is called. We may find out, or we may not.
It said it was a cairn, right?
It talks about the Carn Hills, but only that it splits it from Arbor Alls. And it says some further stuff as we go on to the next paragraph.
Oh, okay.
All right, so immediately we're going to address that. Like I said, this little... two paragraphs here, they just add a little something on the mention of role-playing, and nothing to do really much with the story or with the lore, except as an example of what you could find up in Mauve Castle area, or Maur Castle. All right, I'm going to restart. It's page 291 in the second paragraph. "There is a great ring of stones," Curly began, as they sat in the small parlor adjoining the three bedrooms. "It is near here, within the mountains which split Carn Hills from Aber Alls. There is a hidden valley there, a circular place which is unnatural. Steep walls ring a level plateau, and this ground in turn is hemmed by monoliths. Seven circles of different sorts of stones there are. The size of the stones grows larger as the rings progress inward, from liths no bigger than a milestone to huge ones taller than a giant. These seven rings of stones encircle a cairn at the center. It is that which we must enter and explore." "What is inside?" asked Gord. "Gold, gems." Kurt, not much interested in tales of worthless rocks, perked up at these last two words. "I think not," Greenleaf answered slowly, and Chert looked bored again. "But there is possibly something of far greater worth than the barrow, a relic." "What sort of relic?" Gord queried. "What's a relic?" demanded the barbarian. "A relic is something ancient, usually of great power, and often associated with the divine in some manner," the druid explained. "More than that, I'm not prepared to say at this time." "What's the sense of going there if there's no money in it?" "Chirp, my friend, there is more to life than money, and fighting," Greenleaf said with a wry shake of his head. "There's women there," asked the barbarian with candor. "Or a good sword, maybe." Gord laughed at this, but Curly's response was serious. "No, no, but the relic, if there is one, would have value beyond belief. Should we actually find one and manage to get it into the right hands, you'll both be rewarded with enough money to keep you happy for years, even at the rate you two young rogues spend the stuff." That was hardening talk indeed. Searching for this hidden ruin was making a whole lot of sense now. Gordon Chert expressed their eagerness to get going as early as possible. "Well, there are a few preparations I must make first," the druid cautioned. "Spells, if you don't know it, require more than a few mumbling incantations and a wave of the hand, after all." "What do we need spells for?" demanded the massive barbarian. "We've got swords." "If we find a relic, my boy, then we will certainly have to contend with whoever or whatever guards it. And such a guardian will require more than brute force, even strength such as yours, to overcome. If we are clever and lucky too, we should be able to survive its attacks, destroy it, and bear our prize home in triumph." Gord would say no more on the subject of the relic or its fearsome guardian, whatever that might be, despite the young man's wheedling and demanding. Curly bade them to remain patient a bit longer, assuring both that he would apprise them fully in due time of just what they were seeking and what they might encounter along the way. "After all," he explained, "a A slip of the tongue now could alert others as to what we seek, and there's no need for a contest of getting there first, or having to fight off others after we've taken the prize. Gordonshire agreed to the sense of this approach, and retired to their chambers for the night. Next, all three went down to the town of Mauve Castle, and therein the druid went about gathering whatever he needed for his coming work. After spending the following night in the Manticore's tail, the trio set forth on their adventure, riding south and west toward the mountains. Break. So I had originally thought that this was going to be in the Caledon from things mentioned, but it doesn't look so. Now, it's said here that the I'm not quite sure. There's mention of a valley, a hidden valley, and there's mention of a plateau with the monoliths around it. It mentions a ruined city, but I'm not sure if that is something that is, pardon me a sec, if that is being described as in the hidden valley or a different location entirely. So, I'm not quite sure, reading through this right here, if I have everything exactly correct. And sometimes that is a problem with the book, that you do run into a little confusing geography. For example, we just read about Blemmu Castle, and from the original reading, it seemed to be right upon Nurl. And then a little later, Gygax places it in the Blemmu Hills. And that is how it's mapped. It's mapped pretty far away from Nurl in the Blemmu Hills. If you look at the Darlene map, it has hexes that are full color. So that if the hex is primarily hills, it's brown with hill shapes. And if it's primarily open terrain, then it's all like open green. But it does not mean that necessarily those things are in the right place. Darlene's maps are 10 leagues across. And then when Anna Meyer did her maps, she had them as 12 miles across it. And 10 leagues would be, double the size at, around 30 miles a hex. So there's a lot of things that are not quite in a defined place on the Darlene map. Now, it could be north of Nurl, the Blemmu Hills are starting out right there, rather than being further away, because there's nothing that specifically says. So here we are supposed to find a circular hidden valley that is unnaturally circular. It is supposed to be near to, because they mention that it is near to Mauve Castle, which, again, I'm not a little confused about the spelling here. It is definitely spelled in the book Mauve, where it should be, according to the other sources, Maur Castle, Maure. That is seemingly a problem. In this, that what we've just read, I have broken here on page 292, because it is also the end of chapter 27. But there are a number of things here. We, as the story's going, we learn about some game mechanics that are turned into, things here about how the story includes game mechanics written into it. Curly explains to them that spells require more than a mumbling incantation and a wave of the hand. So it's the business of learning spells and sleeping and memorizing them as we have the mechanics, and being expressed here as a story, just a part of the story. So what we have as far as lore, we've got this explanation of the Great Ring of Stones near to Mauve Castle within the mountains which split the Carn Hills from Aberall's. And there is the hidden valley, unnaturally circular, with steep walls ring a level plateau. And that, I'm not sure if that means there is a plateau within the valley. It kind of sounds that way to me. And then there's monoliths starting very small, getting to be bigger than giant size. And there's a cairn at the center. So that does not really describe a ruin to me, you know, I don't know, maybe it's supposed to be a ruined cairn, but I had the idea it was a ruined city. So maybe that might be in a different area, you know, perhaps the Celadon. That seems to be what's striking me, but I may be wrong. So then we have the explanation of what a relic is, mostly in story terms rather than the general idea. But the idea is that it is a powerful item and that it would have some kind of guardian, which, you know, makes sense, but isn't necessarily, universal. I mean, I don't believe you should always have your game tied to certain facets that happen again and again and again. So, you know, a relic might be something that is just discovered, hidden, if it's part of the DM's idea within the story, if it's better to have it as a hidden item, but not a well-protected one. Because you don't necessarily have to follow a set pattern with adventure, and I would say that you don't have to worry about balance as a DM, that you're the balance. And even though things may be discovered or encountered that are much more powerful than the game mechanics have for the character, it is just part of what you might find in a versatile game setting, rather than something, you know, like some of the online games like World of Warcraft. They have certain areas that are certain levels, and they're always going to be that way, that you're not going to encounter a monster of greater power if you're out of that area. And so, you know, it adds a very gamey feel to the game setting. But in this, and even if you're running a game, I always like having a very open feel, that there are reasons why there are safer areas where you're unlikely to counter powerful creatures or foes, but at the same time that you may, even at like a first level character, run into something well beyond the power of the game characters to work with. And at that point, it becomes a matter of how the characters role play out those scenarios. You can encounter a dragon at first level and have your characters surrender to the dragon, and then the adventure can be escaping from the dragon rather than trying to fight off a foe that would obviously destroy you. All right. I'm going to restart.
I thought they might be headed to that cave in that map that I posted in the Arbor House.
Yeah, there is a thing marked cavern. It does say it's not a cavern, though, that it's a cairn rather than caverns. It is, I think, in the right location in a sense, except it appears to be right upon a roadway. And there's a couple caves in the area, but I don't know. And there is something about a crypt, that I see on this smaller scale map. But, it's supposed to be a circular valley with a cairn in the center. And that, I'm not quite sure that matches up with anything shown on this map right here. And how far off they're going to be. I can't really see anything that it might be. All right.
Yeah, and I forget, so I guess we're just going to have to listen.
Yeah. All right, I'm going to restart. It is page number 293, chapter 28. If the Aberalls was a place where horses could not easily venture, the mountainous head of this area was far worse. The three riders took a southerly route along the edge of the jutting peaks that rose abruptly from the relatively level plain to the east. The entire chain was only some 50 miles long and about half as wide, but the upthrust bluffs and craggy peaks were an impenetrable wall. Perhaps determined mountaineers could ascend these great mountains and descend on the other side. No regular traffic, muleback, or even a foot, could find a route through them. Gord wondered out loud why they were riding along the edge in such a fashion when it was obvious that they would have to proceed afoot eventually. It would have been better, he suggested, to have left their valuable steeds in some safe stable and have gone on Shank's mare. Break. All right, so, you know, so this area here is supposed to be very near Mauve Castle, and the, you know, in the mountainous area. But, you know, again, there's no definite distance being said. I mean, does he mean near as in several days' travel? Does he mean near in half a day's? We really don't get that. But we do get report that the Aberalls here are impassable. I'm not sure if there's anything shown on the Darlene map for this area. Now, if you look at the Darlene map, which was shown on the July 20th here on the fiction text part of the Cannon Fire Discord, what it shows is, as Gygax described, the Mauve Castle is on the northern edge of the Aberalls Mountains, which are only 1 hex wide and 2 hexes from north to south. Now, on Darlene's map, the hexes are roughly 30 miles a hex, so that's 50, 60 miles, as Gygax has described right here, and, you know, 30 miles across or thereabouts. And in that area, there are no roads shown, but, you know, this is the Darlene map, which doesn't really show roadways. But from the description that Gygax is giving, anything south of, of Mauve Castle is going to be impenetrable. That bit of mountain range is going to be impenetrable to roadways. And as, you know, Gygax is describing right here, you'd need a mountaineer to get from east to west over those mountains. So you're not going to be having game trails, roadways. And also, if we, you know, jump down to this other map, it shows quite a few things right here within the Aberalls Mountains. Roadways, there is a town called, or city called, or a fortress, I'm not quite sure, called Dumadan. And there is a road that goes right west through those mountains, a little southwest of Mauve Castle, and then a road that goes through the eastern edge and another that leads to that Dumadan. And, it does make me wonder if, right here, if they change things for what was in the later material. Now, it does seem that a lot of the material here in the Gord books, at least the first two, which were published by TSR, were looked at when they redid the setting for From the Ashes, because I find a lot of things that Carl Sargent might have renamed that are only otherwise mentioned in the Gord the Road books. So obviously they were aware of at least these first two books and used information from them. So it does lead me to question some things about this map, whether they simply decided to ignore some of the things from the Gord the Rogue and, you know, reset them in their own way, which was always, you know, there was nothing really locked down in the original setting. And the Gourd books, while, you know, very useful, they are only talking about Guy Gax's novel version of the setting, not even the way he might have played it in his own campaign. So the Gourd books are kind of unique unto themselves, but considering the previous material that was released was so bare bones that it has so much detail, more minute detail than you got in the folio or the 83 box set or the modules, and there really wasn't much else about Greyhawk at the time. But here we get a description of the area in those Aberall Mountains, upthrust bluffs and craggy peaks, an impenetrable wall. No regular traffic, muleback, or even a foot could find a route through them. So, here we have, and then, you know, like Gourd is commenting here that it seemed a better idea to go through these mountains on foot than going through on, trying that they wouldn't even be able to take a horse. And they value these horses quite a bit. All right, I'm going to restart here. It is page number 293, third paragraph. Druid assured Gourd that he knew what he was doing, and he told both men to keep a sharp eye out for a small tor shaped like an ogre. Chert's keen gaze spotted this unusual-looking mountain late in the forenoon. It was quite as Curly had described it, once you knew what you were looking for and viewed it from the north. Rough, rocky ground near its base was forbidding, as were the clumps of scrub thorn that sprang from the poor soil between the mineral outcroppings. Now we must dismount and begin looking for a dry stream bed, Greenleaf instructed. There is a way up the range along it, and it passes the valley we seek, too. How do you know that? Chert asked as the three began leading their horses through the rough terrain. A party fleeing the wrath of a Despotrix of Hardby came over these peaks and down into the duchy. Eventually, one of the few who survived ended up telling his tale, and somebody else wrote it down. Break. All right, so, besides giving here a little physical description of how to find the valley and the mention of the unnamed stream bed, we have a little information, a little histories for the story and the lore of it being discovered by a party fleeing the wrath of Despotrix of Hardby. And I wonder if that is implying a former Despotrix or if there is more than one at a time. Offhand from Hardby, I believe the Despotrix was the overall ruler, and there would only be a single one at a time. So that comment seems to be speaking about some time in the past that passage through to the valley was discovered. All right, I am going to restart. It is page number 294, the fourth paragraph. Fine, I suppose, allowed Gourd. How do we know it's a true account? It could be a yarn spun for fun or profit. We don't actually know for certain. I quander stressed that point repeatedly, Curly answered. So far, though, everything checks out, and the survivor's description of the ruin in the depression matched exactly what I picked up from other sources. That, my boys, he couldn't have made up. What we must do now is find the path that he claimed took their fleeing band down into Ernst's green fields, the place from where we shall travel upward to our goal. A dry stream bed heading up toward Ogre Peak is what we must find. Right. All right. So we have a place within the Aberalls named Ogre Peak by Curly. And he's not just, you know, he's using that as a definitive name for that peak. And then we also have the comment about the ruin in the Depression. So the Carn is, I guess, the ruin. I even said tonight that it was a ruin in Caledon Forest, and it just looks like I was completely mistaken, that it is a ruin within the Aberalls Mountains, and that it is kind of a ruin of a Carn rather than a city. I'm read these books before, and I guess I'm jumping ahead. There is a ruined city, I believe, in one of the further books, and in a forest, and that might be in the next novel, Artifact of Evil. All right. Now, I'm going to restart. It is page number 294, and the third paragraph from the end. "That makes sense to me, Curly," said Chirp. "Even though there's no trees covering the tors ahead, I was raised in country nearly as rough as this. I can find what we're looking for." Ord knew that was not an idle boast, and when the druid said he was fairly adept at such work himself, Gord reconciled himself to tagging along and letting the two of them worry about the matter. However, on Curly's advice, they split up, each staying within hailing distance of another, able to search more ground than if they traveled in a close group. After less than an hour of walking and looking, Gord got a surprise. Had he not been holding tight to his horse's reins, he would have tumbled headlong down a steep drop-off, screened by weeds and grass. The narrow gully obviously served as a watercourse when rain fell on the mountains above, and drained along its channel. Gord walked along the drop-off for 100 yards and saw that its path seemed to curve upward. He called for the others to join him and continued moving along the wash. He called out excitedly several more times before Curly and Chirp caught up with him. The city-bred thief had indeed found the purported route into the heart of the mountains. But he saw no need to reveal that he had merely and quite literally stumbled upon it. Whether or not it would eventually take them to the Vale of the Ringstones, the stream bed did enable the adventurers to take their horses upward. The work was slow, however. There were twists and turns at first, and then the gully became a canyon. There were boulders and heaps and splits that had to be explored. The going was steep and rough, and the three were tired when the sun began to slip behind the jagged mountaintops ahead of them. They started to look for a suitable place to camp, and soon found a broad ledge jutting out from the canyon wall above them. It took some arduous work for the men and the mounts they led to pick their way along an oblique route that took them gradually up the canyon wall until they reached the outcropping. It turned out to be well worth the trip. The ledge was sheltered on the sides and top, almost as if they were in a shallow cave with a projecting lip at its entrance. Chirp went out to gather forage for the horses, returning with a great armful of coarse grass and other shrubbery he found in the immediate area. The men ate a cold meal from their trail rations, washed down with a little water. When Gord complained about their shortage of drinking water, the druid pointed out that a rain would bring them more water than they might like. Gord shuddered as he considered the prospect of being caught in the big ravine as it flooded. This was a risky venture indeed. Break. First thing off my mind is that Curly is a 10th level druid. You know, according to what we found as in the 8th circle, he'd be a 10th level druid. And without looking at the spell list, I had always believed that being to summon up water was one of the aspects of the druid's spell. Now, and fairly low level too, it's possible that Curly just simply doesn't know that spell. But going into such forbidding territory, it would seem that that would make sense to have known that spell or acquired it somehow. So we've had a long bit of reading here, but it is, in a sense, mostly action. We get a little of the geography of the area, and which is lore in itself. I mean, that does give you some detailed descriptions of the path to this adventure locale. So if you were going to, you know, do this adventure yourself as a scenario, then you would, appreciate, or, you know, it's a good little source you could use of the physical difficulties of getting there. Now, since Curly was not aware of the terrain in this depth, it does make me wonder again. It was very timely. It helped them, make time to bring the horses along. But really, what were they going to do with them? Now, it seems like I thought there might have been some creature or something he'd known where they could leave the horses safely. I don't know if they're going to bring... They've now reached a more... a dangerous and rough terrain that might not be able to be taken. So it does, you know, really make me wonder what the plans are for the horses. I mean, it's a little thing there. Now, Chris has posted the druid spell list, and create water is a second level spell. In a lot of campaign terms, it's a very underused spell because some games don't even worry about, feeding or drinking. You know, it's just a lot of hand-waving sometime. But in this sense right here, with the plans for a wilderness, a real wilderness scenario here, you would think that a 10th level druid would have the means to have learned that spell and would have... prayed for it to take with them. There are a few little things. There is a cure light wounds, charm person or mammal, bark skin, heat metal, fire trap. So there, produce flame, warp wood. So there are several good and handy second level spells. I think a lot of times create water would be at the bottom of the list for a lot of gamers. But, for this particular scenario and for the story, I would think there'd be create water and gourd. Curly Greenleaf would simply use it, you know. All right. We have a little here. You know, it's about, how Curly and Chert are both very experienced with rough terrain and making their way through it. A little more of Gord always does to have seem to have like luck, and it always seems to me that luck should be a character ability in the game. It speaks a little bit to the characters of Gord, Curly, and Chert here, about Curly and Chert's confidence and about how Gord himself doesn't want to say that it was luck in his discovery, that it was more skill than luck, when it really was, as described, it was luck. All right. Now I'm going to restart. It is page number 295, second paragraph from the end. All right. Almost as if on cue, the stars were blanketed by clouds, and rain began to fall around midnight. It was a gentle rain, and it lasted for most of the night. Then, when the sun began to rise, the light seemed to dissipate the precipitation. By now, however, the canyon held a gurgling, rushing torrent of water, and for a few tense minutes the flood slowly mounted higher toward their shelter. Then, as it began to recede, rumbled, and another storm broke. This time the rain pelted down in fat drops, accompanied by gusty winds, rippling forks of blue-white lightning, and rumbling bangs of thunder that were intensified and echoed by the mountains around them. Here was a display that made the magic of mankind seem pale stuff indeed. A break. There's a little, I believe this is, there's a little sequential area here at the bottom of the paragraph. I changed it around to make sense to me, and I think it should have been written that way and just wasn't caught by the editing. This little bit here about the rainfall and the description heavily reminds me of the scenes from The Hobbit. And I don't know, Gygax was very influenced by several writers, and in this book, you really get the Lieber influence, and a lot of things that seem very Tolkien-like. Not so heavy, but still, I think you can real see Tolkien and Lieber having an influence on the formation of Gygax's writing. All right, it's page number 290. I'm going to restart here. It's page number 296 and the first paragraph. As quickly as it came, the storm ceased, but the water was again rising. This whole process continued throughout the day, penning the men and animals in their rocky shelter and threatening to sweep them away as the level of rushing water rose higher and higher. Finally, when the torrent had come up over the floor of their shelter, and they were standing in water that was already knee-deep, Charlie Greenleaf resorted to the use of his power. He called up a howling cyclone wind that pushed the flood down in a way sufficiently to allow the party to escape, nothing worse than wet feet and a chill. They passed an uncomfortable night marooned on the ledge, but the druid's enchantment had forced the waters to recede enough for the three to recline and sleep fitfully on the damp stone. The light of morning revealed only a trickle of water in the canyon below them, and the bedraggled adventurers left their haven and pushed upward again, skirting pools and taking respectful note of the destruction caused by the pouring stream created by runoff from the slopes around them. "Next time we camp on a higher ledge," Gord said with finality as he observed the battered and drowned remains of a hill giant, somehow caught by the onrush of water. His companions agreed. Break. All right, so we have an encounter with the body of a hill giant. And although they've been mentioned a few times before, this is, you know, it does, here's a little thing to make you wonder, what kind of torrent it would be to drown a hill giant. Now, originally, hill giants were not as gigantic as they became in second edition, where I believe they topped out around 9, 10 feet high, and in second edition, they were about 16 feet high on average. And so, you know, it does add a little, you know, color to what's happening and a little thought of how dangerous a wilderness encounter can be, even with something as natural as a storm and, you know, water running down into canyons and stuff. So it's really something to keep in mind when you're gaming, to think that you can add not only color but challenges to the game just through natural occurrences. You know, it can be, you know, like a scramble and a loss to them of resources and amounts for them to have to escape such a torrent hitting upon them. It can be a learning experience for players to understand how dangerous it is to be in such terrain. So, you know, I do like that Gygax throughout the story he brings up more than just, you know, just sticking to, you know, actions and plot points. He also does make you aware of what is around you in the city, in these mountains. Chris is here showing the Monster Manual version of a hill giant. Now, they look pretty much like a caveman, in a like in skins and barefoot and hairy and dirty and carry a wooden club. And I have always felt that this is not a Greyhawk hill giant. Even though almost everything from these Monster Manuals back in first edition is timed with Greyhawk, Gygax writes in G1 a very, very different kind of hill giant. In fact, you look at the intelligence, which is supposed to be low. Now, go and look at G1, and that could be a hall of Saxons, or, you know, it could be something that is much more advanced. They are using, you know, metal weapons. They have a built, you know, the steading is a little fortification with multi-levels, a tower, an alarm bell. They dress in shoes and pants. They have a kitchen where the giantesses are wearing aprons and using pots and pans. No, this hill giant to me does not say, they are not low intelligence. This does not say to me, Greyhawk hill giant. If Nasra and the others, the other hill giants in that area, are more like, you know, from a culture similar to, you know, what you might find in like the yeomanry. You know, you might find that in anything that is an, you know, a medieval, close to first century culture. So, you know, you probably pre-conquest from, you know, 1066 is the Norman conquest. And so I think that Gygax, who, you know, who wrote G1, is taking the hill giants and making them like Saxons. And then he takes the frost giants and makes them look Norse. And then finally, the fire giants, they're in a much more advanced technology. They look like later medieval. They're in various armor, and they're smiths, and you know, the hall of the fire giant king is of fit stone, and you know, so I really don't think that the hill giant presented in Monster Manual 1 reflects a Greyhawk hill giant, and I think that's more likely, and for me, likable, than having this giant that can barely speak with his low intelligence. And just using wooden clubs and dressing in bearskins and barefoot when you compare it to what the G modules are like. All right. And then, you know, so in this part where we've broken, we have, you know, Gord showing a little Gord character, and he's not going to subject himself to the risk of drowning. So, you know, his firmness in that they're going to, you know, push on toward a higher and safer area coming through the mountains. And, of course, Gord has not had the experience. He's a city boy, and he's done some crossing of the plains and riding horses and getting on the river and, you know, learning that from the Rene and the Atloy, and then some experience going through the woods. But, you know, he is not, he is learning, though. He's learning. And in this, I've always mentioned that here is a skill that your characters can learn as, you know, as Gord is learning a little bit about mountain travel, wilderness travel. That is something that, in the game sense, you'd want to add to his character background, probably even more so than a point skill system where you get a certain amount of skills per level. I think it should be simply a role-playing aspect of encountering things, of taking time to learn things like riding, that you want to have that as something that the character first learns and then practices. So I think there's a very good role-playing aspect to look at with the character development, the player character development in the game, the way that Gygax shows Gord's growth, and even Chert's, as Chert is now experiencing things in the city. So I think it's all these things which are notable that should be listed down as experiences, keeping track of, some information in the role-playing. All right. I'm going to restart. It's page number 296 and second paragraph from the end. With drinking water no longer a problem for some time to come, food became their next concern. They had sufficient quantities of iron rations to last them a week, and some grain for the animals, too. But it was safer to augment the former by hunting, while allowing the animals to browse on the sparse vegetation that had survived the flash flood. After the group traveled for the better part of the day and found another likely place to camp, Gord was put in charge of the animals, while the barbarian and the druid sought game for their evening meal. The hobbled mounts knew what to do without direction, but Gord needed to be alert in case of attack by some hungry predator. A mountain lion, drawn by the scent of horses, did make an appearance, but several well-placed stones from the young thief's sling sent the creature away amidst a great amount of hissing, spitting, and caterwauling. After calming the terrified animals, there was nothing else for Gord to do but wait. His friends eventually came back bearing a small goat, and that night they ate roasted meat instead of cold rations. The partially cooked portions left over from their feast would provide ample food for the following day as well. So at last, the party felt confident in moving ahead. A break. Now, again, adding a food is, I think another thing here that is not a particularly high-level druid spell. And I don't know what the barbarians' abilities are, non-magical, but hunting like they're doing here. It just seems to me that Gygax is not doing the... I've never particularly liked the create water and provide food spells. I'd rather make the game so that those spells didn't exist, to add to the challenge of the players and the idea that they needed to be concerned about food, they needed to be concerned about water, because depending on the temperament of the players, that kind of thing, it creates a sense of time and necessity, and it brings a campaign with a lot of magic and a lot of enhanced abilities down to earth, that they still need to drink, they still need to eat. And so I don't like it hand-waved away by saying, oh, well, we have magic, and magic's going to provide us with food, and it's going to provide us with water. And so we need to no longer be concerned about that. And I like it when the players are concerned about, different things. And having that as a daily concern, I find that to be a good thing. All right, we do see here that Gord, he's certainly not inexperienced with the sling. And that also he is able to calm the terrified animals, which calming horses is not necessarily an automatic ability. So he has in his background at some point some kind of animal husbandry. All right, I'm going to restart. It's page number 297, second paragraph. Travel the next day was even more torturous than it had been before. They were forced to scissor their way up the steeply rising slope, and at day's end, Curly estimated that they had walked 5 miles while actually only progressing about half that far toward their goal. The area was so barren that not even savage beasts or monsters cared to inhabit these mountains. That, at least, allowed them yet another night of undisturbed rest. Although they kept vigilant watch, nonetheless, all three still had vivid memories of the dead hill giant, and this made them alert to danger of all sorts. Another half day of similar trekking brought them to the virtual summit of the narrow range. Greenleaf made careful observations of the terrain as they struggled upward, and finally, as they approached the highest elevation, he pointed to the left, calling the attention of his companions to what he saw. "At last, see that defile there, and the notch in the crest above? That's where we must go," the druid told them. "The account says that a hidden valley lies beyond, and therein is the depression and the ringstones. If we press on, we can be there before nightfall." Hurry they did, and they arrived at the place, panting and sweating, but feeling exhilarated by success. Before them was the plateau, a gentle mound of stone and vegetation, surrounded by harsh cliffs and peaks. Grasping in the thin air, they worked their way up the rising ground to see what it hid from their view. When they arrived atop this mound, the last light of the sun showed them the unnaturally circular dell and the ring of stone within it. "Now you must trust my judgment, right, lads?" the exultant druid exclaimed with glee. "I knew it was here." "We really thought you were taking us on a will-o'-wisp hunt, Curly. Do you think we'd have gone through all this crap?" Agord Chert agreed. "Scurrying around in mountains is fun, but I came along on this one to get rich." While Gord's opinion about clambering over mountains was at odds with that of his barbarian companion, the intent of both statements was the same. They had accompanied Greenleaf on the strength of his information and his conviction. Even if they had voiced occasional doubts, both adventurers had actually trusted in the druid and expected to find what they were now gazing upon. Gord thought it interesting that Curly seemed more surprised at the actual discovery than his associates were. This night's camp was a cheerful one, despite their meager meal of tough dried meat and coarsely ground grain softened with a bit of vinegar and water. Scant supper finished, they discussed the plan of action for the next day. Break. This will be, the break for the night. But so we get a little more physical description of the area onto their little adventure here. And I wonder about what the plateau looks like, as the description leaves me a little confused. The plateau seems to speak of a high flat area, and I wonder, is the defile within the plateau, like at its center, or is it next to the plateau? I seem to think that it is actually within the plateau, like a little central depression there. I'm really not 100% sure. We get some, now jumping over to the story itself, the language is a little out of place. From Chert and, a little from Gord, I think, that he does go back and forth from a kind of fantasy medieval style of language to like a more early 20th century language. There's, like a little bit about character here, about the belief that Gord and Chert have in Greenleaf, and that Greenleaf himself was not overly confident of what they were going to encounter. All right, this is the final break. It is page 298. It is July 21st, 2021. And I'm anybody have any comments? Because otherwise I'm going to summon up Craig and end it for tonight.
I'm good.
Okay. So I don't know. There's a lot of disagreement that I have found about the Greyhawk Hill Giants. And, that is, I don't know how many people agree with me or see the Steading as an aberration from this description of the Hill Giants from the Monster Manual, and whether they're, I've heard people say they're just like an advanced society trained of Hill Giants, and I just don't buy that myself. But anyway.
Yeah, I'm not sure about that, but yeah, we can, I'd have to look to see.
Yeah, it's just, I really love the G-Series, so, I've really thought a lot about G1, and I've always found that this kind of doesn't match in, and, it leaves the Hill Giants as the dumb cousins, because right away you get to the Frost Giants, who are pseudo-North, and the Fire Giants, who are definitely solidly, Normanish, they're more like getting past the Middle Ages right there.